Labor Commerce Committee is called to order at 1:35 on Tuesday, February 23rd. Members present are Representative Copeland, Boucher, Menard, Ellis, Donley, and Representative Phillips is also present. This afternoon, we'll hear briefly from a Yukon legislative delegation from Canada on the joint Alaska-Yukon tourism marketing agreement and on the issue of economic development, and hear some advice on how they handle economic development within their jurisdiction. And at 2 o'clock, we'll take up the confirmation hearing on Commissioner Jim Sampson from the Department of Labor. At 2:30, we're going to proceed and hear House Bill 116, extended termination date of the Board of Electrical Examiners. Representative Phillips, would you like to introduce the members of the Yukon delegation? The record should reflect Representative Davidson joining us.
Yeah, I'll just introduce the members of the Assembly while getting into the titles. This is Dan Jove, Robert Cassie, Tony Pennicott, Lee Firth, Dan Lang, Pierce McDonald, and Doug Phillips. And then this is Kurt Renard from the Mansu area, Cliff Davison from Kodiak, John Ellis from downtown Anchorage, Donnelly from Spinard, which is, West Anchorage, sort of?
Yeah, sort of.
Neil Copeland, of course, you know, is from Fairbanks, and Red Boucher from the Hillside area, close to it, right?
Midtown.
Of Anchorage, that is.
Well, welcome. We've been looking forward to meeting with you and hearing some of your experiences. I'll just turn the floor over to you.
Maybe, Mr. Chairman, I could, rather than starting with the tourism agreement, because I don't know how much there is there to discuss. I think it has generally been a satisfactory experience to us, so unless you had some questions, we would perhaps want to open it up at this point. Let me just say, because at this particular moment, I am leading our government, and we've had to deal with an economic recession, which is kind of out of sync with yours, in that Alaska was still booming, I think, when our economy began to cool off in the fall of 81 and go into a pretty severe recession in the spring of 82, largely precipitated by a downturn in base metal prices, which caused, at one moment during that recession, for every single one of our producing mines to be shut down. The situation in the Yukon economy is that it's extremely leaky, extremely narrowly based, and therefore very vulnerable to international forces, price fluctuations and market conditions. We have three essential industries, mining, tourism, and government, and it was in fact tourism which really sustained us during the recession, in the sense that it did not suffer the same fact that mining did, and mining, of course, brought down the service industry. We suffered a precipitous drop in our population and unemployment in the near 20% range for much of that time. In addressing the situation, we've had to come to realize that we have some great weaknesses, structural weaknesses in our economy, and we have sought to address them by a number of economic strategies, but including some which have been identified recently by your governor as being part of the solution here. And I might like to spend a couple of minutes talking about those and seeing if there's something that we might be the basis of further discussion. One, we are now pursuing a fairly aggressive import substitution strategy. And secondly, attempting diversification where we can, and obviously constraints on it. The import substitution becomes necessary because of the scale of the leakages in our economy. It is literally true that put a dollar in the Yukon economy, 25 cents flows south instantly for imported oil. Another 20 cents flows south almost instantly for imported materials for things like construction. Another dime goes south almost instantly for imported food. We are importing way over 90% of our food, for example. To rectify that structural problem, we have had to address that problem on all three fronts. On the energy front, we are trying to develop local energy sources. We're trying to take public buildings, for example, off oil, retrofit older buildings, and provide incentives for private citizens to do the same. We're building new public buildings which are not heated with oil, but heated with local wood products and local coal, and even garbage. To deal with the leakage on the construction construction materials account, we have decided as a matter of policy we're going to be using local materials to the maximum possible extent, which means our forest products, which means putting people back to work as loggers, sawmillers, carpenters, etc. We are even discovering that it is marginally economic to manufacture our own furniture in some cases rather than import it. And there are possibilities there for using local materials there. We suffer similar constitutional constraints as you do in terms of local hire provisions. And in fact, the local materials option is a policy, which is a development from historic local purchase policy, is providing us one opportunity to pursue what amounts to a policy of local hire there. We're also now investigating the efficacy of putting value-added provisions into our contracts that the government issues, because we're not only the largest builder, but we're also the largest purchaser in our territory. As well, we are, because of that, pursuing efforts which will reinforce and enhance our forest industry and help it achieve more of its maximum potential. At the same time, beginning to develop our agricultural industry to the point where we hope it can substitute, we can have some local substitutes for imported food. In diversification, in order to promote us in a situation where we were in a position to be able to diversify, we really had to take care of the situation in our basic industries first. And we spent the first 6 months in office working on a development agreement with a new owner of our largest mine, Cypress Amble of Farrell, which in its heyday had represented 40% of the gross territorial product by itself. We had a very complicated deal to put that back to work, which involved a transportation agreement with Alaska to ship the ore through year-round on the road through Skagway. Arrangements involving smelter companies in Japan and Korea, financing arrangements with our federal government, and many other elements. Part of the arrangements were of the development agreement were for local hire and affirmative action for native people locally and training opportunities. I confess to you that we have been less than entirely satisfied with the results on that score, but we have made an earnest effort. We are pursuing similar negotiations with other mining companies, and in fact our mining industry is now, in, at least not on the base metal side, but in the case of that one mine which created, gave us another 1,000 jobs, and in the case of a couple of gold mines which are coming on stream, seeing some recovery on the mining side. Forestry, I mentioned, which is an area for us to diversify. Tourism, we are reassessing our whole strategies now. We're in the hope to get a big bang for our buck, because you will recognize that even as compared with Alaska, we're somewhat spitting in the ocean when it comes to marketing. It's very, very tough for us to position ourselves. We are, however, though, in the next few years, going to be really looking at what we can do to diversify, particularly in the renewable resources area. We're very interested in what we can do in fisheries, forestry, farming, those areas, and in small-scale manufacturing. We think we're beginning to see some payoff in some of our strategies, but it really has to do with the combination of both diversifying the economy and substituting wherever possible for imports, especially those which do not have any kind of benefits in employment or business opportunities for our people. Maybe just a way of summary, I can introduce what we've done in that sense. We have the net result, I suppose, is we made job creation our scorecard. Have seen our unemployment rate come down in the last 2 years from something in the 20% range to now where it's 9%, which for the first time in quite a few years is now below the national average. And we hope, since we had 7% rate of growth in 86, we're predicting 6% growth in 1987, we will have be able to bring the unemployment rate down lower than that. We don't know what really constitutes full employment in our territory. We think it's not unreasonable to try and bring it down another point or two in the foreseeable future. Maybe I can just leave it at that, so maybe introducing the topic.
Representative Copeland, and Representative Thatcher.
Yes, you mentioned value-added provisions in local in purchase contracts and building contracts. How do those work?
Well, originally we had, going back to Dan Lang's days when he was in the cabinet, we had, I think, a 10% northern preference, which was a northern preference defined between Yukon and Northwest Territories, which gave a preference to local contractors for public works. There is some continuing dispute about who are northern contracts and which are northern contractors, and the labor movement hasn't been entirely happy with what they've seen as the results of that. There is some question, because of federal-provincial discussions now, about whether they will continue in the context of free trade talks with the United States, whether the interprovincial free trade or such impediments to interprovincial free trade are going to be a problem. Therefore, we think a value-added provision, which some provinces have gone through in Canada, notably British Columbia and Newfoundland, may be a constitutionally acceptable way for us to achieve the same end, at least on larger contracts. We have not yet, I understand we're still going through the development work on this, but it may be that we can say to people that we want maximum possible use of local labor, maximum possible use of local materials, maximum possible use of, and the bidder, if all other things are equal, the bidder who presents the most attractive option on that score may then be preferred, and presumably after a short educational period, the industry will respond, understand that that is a policy priority of the government, and will respond accordingly.
But it's not in effect right now.
No.
You want to make that clear, there's going to be a fair amount of public discussion whether or not this principle will be accepted.
We have been urged to do it by our Contractors Association.
So it's essentially a negotiated kind of contract with a certain parameter.
No, we are considering doing this. Cabinet, we have made a statement to the government that we are now in a process, as Dan says, of consulting with the construction industry, but when and if and how we will do it.
The other thing you should point out, just to interrupt here, Tony, is that policy for local preference for contracting is not by statute, it's just strictly a policy of the government. It would definitely be against the Constitution for the protection of the law like that. So it's just by written policy and utilized accordingly.
Serious question in our country about what the net effect of these things is, because every single jurisdiction in the country has such a policy, and they all are about the same thing, 10%, and after a while, you wonder what the...
Germany in 1840.
Two questions. Do you have a constitutional problem with your local hire thing like we run into?
Yes, we have in the Canadian Constitution a mobility clause which prohibits us from putting barriers up against people who are
moving. Everything's up to date in Kansas City.
But we can take measures in areas of high unemployment. Now we're moving out of that. To rectify for inequities which suffered by racial groups, such as Aboriginal minorities or others. But it is our perception and legal advice at this moment that the kind of local materials policy that we would like to pursue and develop does escape the net, the constitutional net.
Is it a constitutional problem now? Or your Supreme Court, where are you on that?
We haven't been challenged in the court, but any even lay reading of our Constitution would lead us to believe that if we really did what the popular will would have us do in terms of local hire, we would all certainly get taken for it.
And one of the problems that we have here in Alaska, and it may be much the same as yours, you have construction projects in the small villages or the smaller communities, and somebody comes in from the larger places, so to them it becomes, here it's Alaska hire, local hire, and it's a problem that we've never really been able to get together.
Local hire.
Yeah,
is an extremely controversial proposition in our area, and I suspect the only way where we've had any kind of accommodation on that subject is when we have delegated the contracting authority to the local government, and then they have been able to handle the project. But it is, I think we suffered some considerable criticism from our opposition a few months ago when we attempted to make the local community happy about the jobs and business opportunities in that local community.
Yes, right. Well, it would be interesting. I'm just going to, that was one of the questions, if you could provide us, it appears to me everything's up to date in Kansas City rather than being the Yukon or not, because obviously people are people, and work is work, and I imagine you have people migrating from the larger cities when things are going good, and then and which is much the same problem, and really, we've been grasping with that thing since the subject has been there since 61 or 62, and I dealt with it when I was lieutenant governor. But anything you could supply us would be really appreciated. One of the things that I did want to address, and if it's sensitive, don't answer it, was a question I asked them yesterday in transportation. This ANWR problem and the little head bucking that we're doing that Senator Stevens referred to today, and I assume you folks were senators, namely Senator Mondale from Minnesota, wanted that oil coming down where they could put their people to work. So we did kind of pursue a partnership, if you will, of Alaska, Canada, in that gas pipeline. I'm wondering if it's just a case that people are postures and there's a hidden interest, I guess, if your delegation plus ours here could help to breach the problem that maybe the Washington-Ottawa bureaucracy isn't able to do. It might enhance governments, smaller governments working together.
Well, I think the general proposition that maybe two representative, I just want to say that we are appearing before another committee to talk specifically about that issue.
Okay.
So rather than use up the time, let me respond generally by saying, yes, I think there are a lot of these issues about which we should be exchanging information, because I think we obviously have a lot we can learn from you, but there may, dare I suggest, be one or two things that our experience can suggest for you. There are some issues like this which I think also we would be wise to engage in. I have been asked, for example, by the Yukon Chamber of Commerce to raise the question about whether our two houses could pass resolutions talking about direct mail delivery between our two jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're now talking about 3-week delays because they have to go down to Vancouver and Seattle and then back up again. That would assist us in terms of commerce between our two areas. I understand you're going through some serious discussions about the future of your collar systems. We recently had a meeting with the government of the Northwest Territories, just to use as an example, about how, because we're now building a college, quite substantial venture, $40 million plant in Whitehorse, and we will have satellites from that, but whether we should not be discussing between us whether there is not some sharing of resources that we might prudently do there. Why should we offer identical college programs to you and the Northwest Territories again offer a third option for our small populations, when in fact there may be programs that you're offering that we can have taken advantage of in the past, and that there may be some areas of specialty that we might appropriately develop to which your students could have access. I suggest there are a number of things like that which are in our economic interests, both from a trade and commerce point of view, as we have in the past cooperated on tourism, that we should begin to talk to each other much more frequently about them. And to explore the possibilities, notwithstanding the difficulties our nations sometimes have communicating with each other, especially about northern issues.
Representative Menard and Representative
Davidson. Yes, through the chair and Tony, thank you. Your problem with leakage of dollars going out of your district, of course, is similar to things we're trying to deal with. On your federal system, as far as we've had some economists that were up here and said that they are glad that Alaska is under the federal system. Otherwise, we'd have tariffs, 10 miles high coming into the state. What is the position on tariffs?
To be frank, I think I was asked yesterday about free trade agreement between Canada and the U.S. I think given the aggravations that come up recently, Southwood, London, and others, that it may be a while before it's in the U.S. But I think there are a lot of serious practical possibilities for both of us in respect to anything like removing barriers between Yukon and Alaska. And I think maybe we should be exploring some of those, even experimental ways. I mean, we have so many common transportation routes, we have so many common markets, so many common opportunities. It would be a pity for us not to take the initiative in some of those areas. We are a territory, though, that exports most of our valuable product, which happens to be mineral product, to the Asian market. And the only apprehension, I think, or the major apprehension we would have about Canada-US trade arrangements is nothing but prejudice our access to those markets. But I would guess Alaska would have a similar concern on this one, given your export of fish products and so on. We are not interested, I think, in putting up those kind of barriers or tariffs. We don't have capacity, but I don't know if you're interested in doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tony, may I call you by your official title, and I don't really know what that would be.
Government leader.
There are days when I wonder, too.
Okay, Tony.
Okay, thank you, Tony. You did not mention this, what you told us, but I suspect that there's probably a capital shortage in the Yukon as far as development and investment can. There is not a shortage.
There is not at the moment. We have a capital balloon because of some financial arrangements with the federal government in the public sector side. Although the problem of access to capital, particularly venture capital, is extremely difficult in America, and it's national banks, large, multi-bank. I mean, most of our national banks have maybe 1,000 to 2,000 branches. All of our national banks are located in the capital city. We have no local, as you do, financial institutions, so it means that raising capital for whether you're talking about property development or resource development has to be done on either the Vancouver Stock Exchange, the Toronto Stock Exchange, or by trust companies that are not present. And because of our distance from those markets, that is a severe development problem for us. I don't think we're even close to it, so what do you think?
Well, my question is going to be the incentives that you offer for venture capital, but it sounds like you have a rather unique situation. So in the instance where you encourage it, or where in fact foreign capital does come in and develop a specific venture or project, do you in fact take any kinds of, make any kinds of safeguards to ensure that foreign ownership or domination of the situation doesn't get out of hand?
The jurisdiction is in the responsibility of the national government, not ours. And in fact, the previous Liberal government nationally had what they call the Foreign Investment Review Board. I think it's now called Investment Canada under the new Conservative government, who are more interested in attracting investment than it's alleged the previous government was. I should tell you that most of the new capital which has come into the Yukon Territory for resource development area has been United States, well, I can tell you it's been American and Swedish capital, and most recently. There is, and the most conservative participants have been Canadian banks, and that was the most cautious participants in the Canadian banks. There is actually some Japanese capital as well in some of our recent research.
Representative Copeland?
Yes. As you heard today, we do have some difficulty communicating with Washington, even for our elected representatives, and trying to communicate with Ottawa has been totally impossible. But there are some concerns that we have with the Canadian federal government from time to time. Do you have any suggestions about how we gain their ear?
Well, the first instance, I'm not being facetious. I think we ought to be talking to each other much more frequently. I can recall, just if I may use an entirely local example, there was a former governor who should remain nameless with whom we were having great difficulties negotiating what we thought were practical arrangements about the certain road. It did expedite matters. In fact, I think when we began to, in fact, communicate with our friends in the legislature, because in fact, I think what were some misunderstandings were sorted out quite quickly. I think that's a lesson that we, on our side, should not forget. I think the discussion we had with Senator Stevens this morning, I think, is what the Russians would call a frank and comradely exchange. our interventions were more occasional than his, but you know, on issues like that, it is, I suppose, unfortunate that we come waiting in the last instance, only because we didn't know what was happening until we thought things were very far advanced. So, I would very much like to, I think, see our relationship as important enough that when are doing things which can have impact on each other, that we are talking to each other very early, so there are no surprises. I mean, everybody here knows how political issues develop. If you're obliged to consult, one of the parties finds they weren't consulted with, they tend to get either suspicious or angry. Or
even if there's a deal or no deal.
I'm not just referring to the matter between the Yukon and Alaska, but essentially decisions made, for instance, in fisheries or some international issues that are made in Ottawa that affect us, that you have no more early warning of than we do. So that's one of the things. Do you have any particular source of information?
Well, for a couple of years, we were blessed with a situation where our member of parliament was, in fact, the number two person in the country, Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, and that presented both mostly opportunities but also some problems because it's less of a constituency person than the one obviously in that role. But we're now in a situation where we don't know who our point of contact with. To be frank, I hope I say this not disrespectfully, but to assume that using our senator in Ottawa as a pipeline is not a practical option, to be frank. We would normally communicate government to government when trying to deal with Ottawa. Although, like everywhere else, we find that there are bureaucratic agendas which are entirely independent of the political agendas, and occasionally,
there are. We have noticed that,
particularly in Ottawa, we have to. You, you discover by accident that there is some initiative surfacing in the bureaucracy that maybe even the allegedly responsible ministers don't know about.
We have the same problem with Washington.
I'm not surprised.
The same problem with our senator you have.
I've read the present government of Canada fairly positive to the region because they are taking steps in respect to transferring authorities and various things like this to the regional government, specifically to you. They just transferred the power corporation here around a month ago successfully to the government. And, so it's our relationship as far as the government's philosophy is concerned. I think it's, you know, it's good for the outside region. Yeah. As opposed to previous governments.
That does lead us to the point. I mean, we want to talk about worst case scenarios, but since we've just bought North Canada Power Commission, which is the current our government has, you know, it's not inconceivable at some point in the future there may be some basis for conversation with future jurisdictions about power. Mm-hmm.
Well, wasn't there a study completed that was looking at the prospects of providing power here to Juneau by the, I believe it was under, on the ocean?
The of course the power that would be available for that is now needed in Faro, so that's someone up in the back room.
Another question, of course, is the highways and then possible future railway extension, but those are sort of longer term questions. But we have, of course, a teleconference network, and I know I'm stealing Red's question.
That's excellent.
Whether we should not contemplate some sort of more frequent tie or direct tie with the Yukon government between...
It appears the department is now exploring some of the options that are developed for us for in terms of electronic communication, and I think that is something that they maybe could take under that into account.
May I just expand on that? Telenet is up now, and you can, you know, you bang up to Telenet, and you can download to any place in the world. One of the things that you might explore, and Canada is really a leader in moving information digitally, it along with Great Britain and France is light years ahead of what we are doing here. And you got your electronic pages on TV, etc. And I don't know if that's a part of what there's been some fallout in your area. But be that as it may, there is no reason at all why with a minimum of effort you couldn't explore Telenet to where if we did nothing more than set one PC, plug it into a telephone line here, that there's no reason you should not be able to access our database, that's the one that anybody in the state can access, keep track of our bills. You could have a Juno watcher and we could do much the same thing. We have a program called Alexis, which I'm sure would be difficult to share with you. And what we do is we put up our bills, our resolutions, and stuff like that, and that could be done without any multi-million-dollar expenditure. In fact, I think the entire thing, if you've got mainframes there, which I'm sure you do, you just set a corner of it up, and you're off and running. Sometimes the technocrats give you a fiscal note of millions of dollars when, you know, you could use a small 40-meg PC and keep everything on it. So that's an excellent suggestion.
Just while we're talking on communication, could I just press the point about the mail, aware of our time limitation of time. The new Air North scheduled run between Whitehorse and Juneau and Fairbanks, I think, provides us the capacity to, in fact, deliver mail directly to your jurisdictions. And I'd like to raise with you the possibility that if both our houses were shortly to resolve the matter, because the chambers by themselves can't do anything because governments won't act on the chamber resolutions, neither Canada or U.S., but if both our houses were to address resolutions on this matter, then maybe our respective national governments would respond.
Maybe there's a committee resolution that
Sure.
But,
well, within the
even
just
like
a transportation issue, but
that would go along against the
commerce.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for coming speaking with us today. We really find fascinating.
You
want to
send me that telecommunication?
I've
already loaded him up.
Now, what committee do you go to next?
So they're going to see Don Dickey over at the Division of Tourism for this time.
Oh, okay.
About tourism. So, I'll be willing to work with you or Betty on that resolution,
sure.
Because it is
copy of that resolution that regarding the mail routing, then we could use as a basis for our resolution.
Yeah, you said the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, what I'll do is I'll get Jim Beebe to, when I contact your office. One other thing I might mention is that we're going through partly to address the problem of diversification of a long-range economic planning exercise, community-based in that territory called Econ 2000. There'll be a final conference of it this spring, and it may be that the last one I wish to, since we're so close, at least have somebody sit in and observe the final deliberation on this one.
When is that?
We don't know yet, but
could you just drop us a note when that's going to take place? That'd be wonderful.
Even if the note has to go to Vancouver and then
we'll send it by dog. Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Danny? Just first knowing you, and he left the fire.
No, actually, I just we'll see before we leave.
Are you going to handle the telecommunication?
Here's it.
I want to get a car for you.
Of Jim Sampson as Commissioner of the Department of Labor. Commissioner Sampson, would you like to join us here today? A copy of the Commissioner's resume is in the committee packets, and if any of the members have questions for the Commissioner designee, now's the time to ask away. Representative Menard.
Yes, through the chair to Jim here. I understand that Dan Lang from the Canadian delegation went to school with Mr. Sampson here. And he gave me a list of questions last night at the Red Dog.
Oh, boy.
Here, and I'd like to bring several of them up. That, excuse me, my wife is here.
Oh, your wife is here?
Well, in that case, I guess I will pass.
Are there any other questions?
A Republican with a heart.
Yeah, I had one, and it's on the study that we just got through doing, Jim, and I realize this is past history. I think we've heard you and I have been hearing this resident hire issue for Lord knows how long. I think setting aside the various points of view on the thing that the court has said repeatedly is, you know, we need good information. And so one of the things that I did with 294 and 295 was get an appropriation for about $100,000+, and we did this quick and dirty. I don't know, have you seen that one? That was study number one. And I looked, you know, I've been tracking back. I went in the past year, and I've got back to the first thing written on Alaska Hire in the state that just about filled five files. And the studies, and sometimes there appears to be one Xeroxed off the other. And so when this was presented to us, this was, hey, it's quick and dirty. And in the approach that we took last year, and somewhat like the Canadians, we tried to make, well, maybe areas of unemployment tactic. And I noticed that you made a comment that all of the information hasn't come in yet to really make some intelligent decisions on it. But our approach last year is, okay, we've looked on the broad base, maybe we ought to look on it by different employing areas, and I don't know whether that really candidly works or not. But one of the things, so last year, through all the heat and battle, we ended up with $300,000 to get a study, and the study was done. And I realize you've just hit the desk, and here the study is done on it. But going back through this, looks like it was a lot of Xeroxing done. I am disappointed in the information in here. First they said, as I understand it, and I don't just understand it, I know what was said in those testimonies, that first of all, we were going to tackle construction, and specifically oil and gas and the construction industry. Then the next year we were going to attack fishing and tourism. And I am just concerned that we don't take a step back. And, you know, because new rooms tend to sweep clean, and lots of times that's good. But in order to get our information in focus, and I realize this may take a little time, now, first thing, when you take a survey or a sampling, anybody says, what was the methodology? You know, who did you sample and what have you? I have reason to believe that this was thrown together in a big hurry in about the last 90 days. I said reason to believe. And that some of the interviewing was pretty sloppy on it. Now, we indicated when we appropriated, originally the figure was 500,000. Then we had to battle, but we managed to hold the figure at 375,000. Now, the same amount of money is in this year's budget to do the thing. And I think you, as well as any of us, we're no better than our information. If the courts challenge what we do, they repeatedly said, hey, your information is lousy. I would like to find out, before I could in good conscience support appropriation for $300,000, what their methodology was, who they talked to, number of interviews. Now, somebody must have kept track of this. Now, I'm not being negative about it. I really, there were a few pages that looked like they'd just been listed out of this one. Now, maybe I'm totally wrong. Maybe they use the same database for information. But this, to me, that looks like it. And I recognize that you just had to come on board and put the thing together. So that we're not bumping into each other on this issue, because it's going to be before us again, that we all start with the same basis of information. So that's, and I'd like to congratulate you, and as I told you before, we may have had our little differences of opinion, but I'm here to give you all the cooperation and help that I can.
Thank you, Brett. Commissioner, do you have any response? Have you had the opportunity to?
Well, I've had the opportunity to read the report issued by the department that we presented to the governor and legislature on the 3rd of January, and I must admit I did not review both documents together. We will provide the information as it relates to the methodology used and the reasons why we're requesting the same appropriation in FY8 as we did in FY7.
Has there been any further development on the aspect of the social ills research?
Well, it's my understanding that we're collecting data now by occupation. The purpose, of course, is to show the use of how non-residents displace residents, and due to that displacement are caused the social ills that we see today, such as unemployment, crime, and those types of things. That data is being collected. Why it was done, Mr. Chairman, two steps or three steps, I don't know. We are collecting data by specific occupation and specific work location tied into the census area. So it's just going to take us a while to form a base. The world is getting bigger, and we should have it this year.
Jim, I'll be glad to share anything I've got with you. This is just one of five books and studies on this subject. Like this one here, Lower Yukon Kuskokwim Labor Market Analysis. This is another study. This is another study. This is another study.
Well, I'm not saying they don't do a lot of studies.
Talking about the.
As far as some of the other studies, we will here this year do plan on looking at our programs that we do have in research and analysis to really see the benefits of what we're doing with the data and information we collect, if it just sits there and being disseminated out. We're going to review each and
current state of workers' comp?
Well, we, there's some differing views by the participants of the system as it relates to the employers, the injured workers, the providers, the attorneys, the insurers. The rates were increased here last year by the Division of Insurance. I know the construction industry, I spoke before them this morning, they had some questions on the system. My view is that the system, two main participants is the employer who pays the premiums and the injured worker, and that the department is willing to support and assist employers in labor and review of the system. The old ad hoc group that was formed for a number of years and came before the legislature together to offer legislation in 82, 3, and 4. We're willing to look at that group and assist them by, you know, with our staff to review the system. I will say that in the testimony before the on the rate increases, my understanding, some of the testimony, or a lot of it, was the level that the benefits injured workers receive, the rehabilitation system is not properly working. The system may be out of balance, maybe tilting too much toward the injured worker, those types of things. There was some legislation, I believe, that the legislature passed in 82 or 84 that changed the compensation of benefits. And I'm not saying that we would not look at that again. But I'm saying that some focus, in my view, should be put on the other participants, the providers, the doctors, the attorneys, the insurance companies. And if there is a review of workers' comp, we would... old ad hoc labor group is in the management group is trying to get back into business and look at the system, and we're there to do what we can.
If I could just follow up through the chair, I just brought that up, Jim, because you know, we hear both sides of that, you know, sitting on this side of the table, and you know, there's the argument made that any further increase in rates you know, would put a lot of contractors right over the edge. And then we've heard through other legislation that's come through the HES committee as well as this committee about workplace safety, you know, hazardous physical agents is one of those we've considered, and increased fines for workplace safety violations. And so there's the added incentive, I guess, at a time of economic downturn by some contractors and others to not have as a good a record of safety management at the workplace. Because they're trying to cut costs, and I think this is an area where it's reprehensible to try and make savings, but it happens, and we know that. So I just wanted maybe some of your comments. The workers' comp is just one piece of the whole puzzle there, but the whole economic downturn that we're in, what do you see as the ramifications for your department and the responsibilities that you all have?
Well, as it relates to workers' compensation, I don't disagree that as the there may be some employers that may not make
does the system work? We don't have any hard data to really show anybody as far as the rehabilitation results, the results of the system, nor do I think the insurers have that. As far as the economics, injured workers can be injured and we can rehabilitate them, but if we have no jobs in which to put them into society again, the whole system it just doesn't work. So there's just not a lot of light duty jobs out there for a lot of these injured workers. There's no jobs at all. So I think we should look at the rehabilitation system itself.
Any further questions?
Representative Kerman,
would you? Well, if there's no further questions, then I'd entertain a motion to move out the letter of confirmation for Commissioner Designee Sampson with individual recommendations.
So moved.
Any objections? Hearing no objections. Motion passes.
Can I see that list?
Yeah, right.
I'll sell it to you.
Is that it?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let you skate. All right, well, the next matter to come before the committee today, and we're even a minute ahead of time, is House Bill 116, extending the termination date of the Board of Electrical Examiners. And before we get into testimony from the witnesses, I'd like to explain a little of the background on House Bill 116. In 1985, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, pursuant to a sunset review, issued an audit on the Board of Electrical Examiners, recommended that they be sunsetted, and a copy of that audit appears on committee files. Subsequent to that report, the legislature adopted legislation terminating the board as of July 1987, with a year allowed for wind down. And over this past summer, a 7-member ad hoc working group consisting of union and non-union contractors, a representative of the IBEW, and representatives of national and local electrical examiners, along with participation from the State Division of Occupational Licensing, met and ironed out an agreement under which the Board of Electrical Examiners would be continued and the concerns of the committee would be addressed. And a copy of their report is included in your committee files, along with 2-0 fiscal notes and supporting position papers from the Department of Labor and the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. Hearing that, we'll proceed with testimony on the bill. And Kathy Marshall, Occupational Licensing. Representative Sons is available if we need to ask him questions, but we'd have to call him down, and we'll see how things go here.
My name is Kathy Marshall. I'm the Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Commerce. And as you know, an audit was conducted on the Board of Electrical Examiners in September of 1985. At that time, the division concurred with the audit report, although for sunsetting the electrical board, although we supported the continued licensing of electrical administrators. We think that that it is a critical function and needs to be regulated. However, since that time, the board has worked very steadily on implementing the recommendations that were contained in the audit, and we do feel that they perform a function that the division at this time is not able to perform. For example, they evaluate all the work experience of electrical administrator applicants. They provide an appeals process for individuals who fail the exam. There is a lot of technical knowledge in this field that divisions certainly could not serve as experts. And I'm not sure what other kind of arrangement could be made in the absence of the board. I'd also like to mention that currently their fees, fees collected from licensing and permits and that sort of thing, do cover the total costs of not only the board, but all of the costs associated with licensing of electrical administrators.
Thank you.
Questions?
Are there any questions from
Representative? Yes, Mr. Chairman. How often is the exam given?
I'm not sure right off the top of my head. I couldn't answer that.
I have about 3 questions, and I want to know how often the exam was given, what the annual, how many people
above the pass-fail rate. Well, when this audit took place, one of the recommendations in the audit was that the exam be revised. Prior to the exam being revised, the pass or the fail rate was 73%. The board did revise the exam to separate out certain categories of licensing or of categories of examination questions, and as a result of that, the pass rate is now 61%. We still have concerns about this. We think that's too high of a failure rate. I'm sorry, failure rate, not pass rate. And we would like the board to do another analysis of the exam.
And through the chair again, are there any regional exams like we're looking at on the dental exam and stuff? There are no regional, so it's not anyone coming to Alaska has to come up here.
It's even worse than that, in that no states will release their examination results. So we can't even trade examinations to try to figure out, you know, the best exam to administer. And there is no licensure by credentials for that reason as well.
Thank you. Representative Ferguson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the Marshall. As I understand, the exam is comprised of a series of questions developed nationally. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
So the questions are developed locally?
Yes, and a number of years ago, the division was awarded $85,000 to contract with consultants to design, independent consultants to design the exam. That did occur, but these categories were still combined at that time, these categories of questions, and that's why they had the high fail rate. Now, we've, you know, separated those categories, and we're down to the lower fail rate.
Has anyone reviewed those questions to perhaps compare those to the course offerings or the course offerings to see that they're at least germane to the subjects being taught?
I'm anticipating that that is going to be the approach that the board will take.
In line with the question here, we ran into problems that people were taking examinations unless they were alignment and there were telecommunications questions in there. This is not, do I remember correctly, because this was the big problem. And of course, as you're well aware, I got caught in the middle of a former representative for my district and probably with his cousin's concerns. I do hope that is resolved. So I won't get beat on the air again this year. Are you dealing with that so I can get out of here?
Yeah, I think that's been accomplished.
Good. Now, what about back to the seriousness of telling these mixed questions where people aren't, that isn't even their specialty field?
Well, that has been taken care of. It.
No. The telecommunications. In other words, when you're a question to a lineman, he's getting, if you will, lineman's question.
Yes, outside, what happened was outside line work was combined with outside communications questions. And that now has been separated out. So you can get four categories of license, actually five different categories of a license. Initially, I think that was the consultant's goal was to give sort of a super license. So if you had a this license, you could do both outside line work and outside communications. But in reality, most people wanted had the individual specialties, and that's now possible to get licensed in those specialties.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kopner?
Yeah, thank you. I realize that one alternative is to develop state inspectors. I can't imagine ever being able to hire that many of them. And I have no particular problem with a fail rate, feeling that in any profession it's more desirable to have competent people than to have allow incompetence in. They may not be as necessary here as in medicine or dentistry. But I noticed you have five categories. Those states like Washington cited in here, they have a pass rate of 1 out of 297. Because they allow anybody to take the exam. So do you have some sort of pre-qualification requirement?
Yes, we do. I don't know exactly what we have. We have developed a checklist and all the different documents that are required, like different kinds of work experience and that sort of thing. are included on that. So those applicants that have met all the qualifications then go to the board for approval.
So they're more likely to have some knowledge. Can a person qualify in more than one category?
Yes.
Representative Menard?
If part of the exam is failed, does the applicant have to go through and retake the whole exam, or are there sections in there that's broken up?
Well, I'm treading on thin ice a little bit because I don't know all the intricate details of this exam. But the way this exam is set up with these five different categories of license, there isn't part one and part two that I'm aware of. Now, there may be, and I don't really know the answer to your question. I can check on that for you, though.
Well, my concern is that, and maybe I'm over sensitive to the fact of, because on the dental board, we always used to catch the heat on the amount of failure rate and what it was. And, you know, all this, and are you trying to limit competition? And our argument all the time was that we're trying to get competent people in the field. And then it used to get in the political arena where someone would come down from the political side and say, you will pass 50% or whatever, we don't care what kind of exam you give, you know. And all these various scenarios come in. And, of course, we finally threw up the towel and went to the regional board outside and over 48. So I did want to look at the statistics. 61% is... sensitivity side from where I'm coming from is it's a high failure rate, I think. And I just want to be sure that there are steps that are taken that it is legitimate.
I will check on the questions that you have.
What is the failure rate?
Well, it was as high as 75% at times, and now it's down to 50. And it varies, it varies back and forth. It flows, depending on what the political pressure is. that's where it is.
I didn't want to hear that.
Right, that's the reality of the process from the AG's office.
Are there any further questions for Ms. Marshall?
Thank you very much. We have additional people to testify if needed. Does anybody on the committee have a problem with?
I call for the question on the motion.
All right. Well, I'll entertain a motion to.
Anybody over here?
Is there a motion?
I was going to testify, and I had a position paper, but if there is a problem with it, I can testify.
Yeah, that seems to be the consensus here. Well, I'd entertain a motion to move the bill to individual recommendation. Any objection? Hearing no objection, the motion passes. And that's, just stick around, sign this letter.
I've worked on that. I must say, it was very frustrating.
While we're passing the sheet around to sign, does anybody have any ideas or anything you want to say? We've got a couple of minutes here, and we're usually so strapped for time. Representative Furness?
Maybe just an update. There are three pieces of legislation that I had to take a look at. One was the PERA. The drafter has it. In fact, you may have had a chance to talk to Terry this morning. And Terry Kramer is working, and she has some ideas. The original draft, she said, would not work in its present form, and had some ideas as to how to clean it up, plus bring over the information generated as a result of a Kenai school district lawsuit. So we should have that, I would assume, within a couple of days. The other has to do with the painting union. Ed Hines, or whatever his name is working on, and we should have that back in a couple of days, too. So. And the third one, I think we're still looking at.
Any other comments from members of the